The Millennial Express, plowing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2023. I'm now here with Frode Midyard. Frode has appeared on Millennial many times, I think every year since 2017. Yes, so this is his seventh time on Millennial. So welcome back to Millennial, Frode.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to be here. I think this is one of the main events of the year. I'm always looking forward to it. It's always a privilege and a pleasure to be here and talk to you. So thank you for having me on again. Yeah, it's 2017. That was when I first got to know you. You know, 2016, 15, 16, 17 was a year when a lot of new names and faces came out, and so I sort of didn't follow all of them, or sort of I didn't get to know all of them. But in, I think, early 2017, your name came up a lot, and I think I asked Greg Johnson, okay, is this guy worth checking out? Is he worth following? And he said, yeah. And so I did, and I was impressed immediately. I thought you did excellent work. And then in the spring or summer of 2017, I invited you to speak at a conference, and then we've stayed in touch ever since. And time flies. It's incredible that it's already 7 years ago.
Oh, yes. It was in Oslo. I think it was in the June of 2017.
Yes, correct.
And I do have still the speech, and I think I've got photos from it. I can't remember if we... Oh, there are no photos of us together. So that's a shame. Mm. But yeah, we had a good time. So it was a lovely conference there, the venue, and I remember being impressed by that and how organized it all was. And then I saw that again. In Stockholm, which I guess was that 2019. Yes.
I think that was 2019, I think you were also on 2018. We were in Copenhagen, Stockholm. I think. It's been so many events now.
Yeah, it was a time when there were so many conferences going on that I really overdid it, actually. I spoke at too many, but I was kind of addicted, I guess, by the end of it. And then I realized I've got to stop. But then it all stopped anyway because of COVID.
Yeah.
So, had it not been for that, I would have toned it. I'd have reduced my involvement in that anyway, just for the sake of, because it's a stressful thing, even as a speaker.
Yeah.
God knows what it must be like as an organizer. I can't imagine it. But even as a speaker, it's stressful to be going to conferences every 3 months or whatever. So I'd planned to step away from it somewhat, but then COVID just switched everything off for basically for 2 years, and we're still recovering from the damage now, even now, nearly four years later.
Yeah, I was actually interviewed a couple of days ago on a channel called Blood Satellite, which I think you've had on as well on Millennial.
Yeah,
the interview isn't out yet. It's going to be out within a couple of weeks, but we did the interview. And one of the issues that came up was the idea of a founding myth, sort of what is the story that we have in common or that we share, which is sort of a founding myth of what we're about and what we're doing. And really, COVID has become one of the sort of founding myths of a shared experience that we've gone through, which is crazy, a unique experience. We went through these 2 years of complete insanity, and I definitely think that we haven't really recovered. We haven't gone back to normal. It feels like we're still sort of halfway asleep because things haven't really picked up speed again. I mean, we have gone back to normal in many respects, but like you said, one example is all the conferences, all the energy that was around in 2017 and also 18 and 19. And then in 2020, everything was shut down. And well, as everyone knows, when you stop doing something and you lose the momentum, it's very difficult to get started again. And so that's definitely something that has changed our world entirely. And it's kind of maybe silly to continue talking about it, you know, the fourth year in a row. But at the same time, it was really a significant event that changed how we experience a lot of things in the world.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't want to talk about it at length. God yeah. knows it dominated the millennial in 2020, 21. Yeah. We were still talking about it a bit last year. It's come up here and there this year, almost just as a sort of background fact that no one can get away from. It's there, yeah. as you say, like it's now a foundational thing in our lives. It's no longer current, and yet it never goes away. It never ceases to be kind of like 9/11. But yeah. actually more so, I think, than 9/11 in a weird way.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, for a lot of people, 9/11, I mean, especially for us in Europe, 9/11 was a sort of an event on TV. Yeah, we experienced it directly when we went through heightened security at airports and so on. But in our day-to-day life, we didn't really experience it. But everyone experienced the COVID lockdowns and so on. And so that is really a sort of a shared experience. And the idea of sort of founding myths is when you go through an event that is a shared experience, which becomes a sort of a common reference point that people can relate to. And so they can relate to each other and talk about sort of a shared event that shapes how they see the world and so on. And how they want to change the world. And so
they can allude to it without having to describe it because the other person already knows because they went through it as well. If you just say lockdown, masks, distancing, vaccine, mRNA, these are terms which immediately elicit all sorts of memories in people and just an overall sense of dread and doom and misery. Yeah. So and the fear of tyranny, the fear of government overreach. I mean, it's awful. It's a crack.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that changed is that social media became even more important than it was before. I mean, before the lockdown, I had basically never even visited Twitter. And it's only because we were kind of restricted to what we can do in the outside world. So, well, we have to do things more online and in social media and so on. And I think that just stuck. That's just how it is now. And so it really changed the sort of norms for how you do things. And one of them is the sort of the increased importance of social media. For good and bad, it's definitely positive and negative effects of that.
Yeah, well, we can probably get into that throughout the course of this. I'm not going to ask you directly about your thoughts on Elon's Twitter. I guess that, again, will come up naturally. It is a thing. But yeah. I think the first thing to talk about this year is the development of the Ukraine conflict. Now, you have quite a different view on the Ukraine conflict from most people who've appeared on Millennial. I don't know if we must have gone into this last year. We must have.
But we talked about it a bit, yeah.
Yeah, it's inevitable. But would you like to give your view of the dynamics there in that conflict?
Well, I think this year in particular has not been very eventful in the war in Ukraine. I think it's gone badly for both sides. I think it's been disastrous for Russia, especially. Of course, it's been bad for Ukraine as well, but especially bad for Russia, because Russia experienced a mutiny. I mean, a mutiny attempt by Prigozhin, who was one of the Russian oligarchs and one of the most visible main figures in the war, and the leader of the Wagner group and the owner of the Wagner group. I mean, just imagine if you had a part of the armed forces marching on London and the British, the rulers in Britain, having to put down a mutiny attempt from their own army in the middle of a big war, and they have a potential civil war going on as well. So I think there's been a lot of chaos in Russia. A lot of people are unhappy with how things have been going, and the mutiny attempt was definitely a very visible sign of that. Course, then the Russian rulers had Prigozhin assassinated in this plane crash, and then also they've had to replace the war command in charge of the war in Ukraine. I think they've replaced it 3 or 4 times since the war started, which is also a sign, of course, that the war isn't going as they want. It's a sign of unhappiness and disunity and chaos, really, in the big players on the Russian side. And also another very important figure or visible figure is Igor Girkin Strelkov, who is was high up in FSB, which is the successor to KGB, the security service, who was one of the main figures, main instigators of the Russian invasion and attack on Ukraine in 2014, and one of the big figures in the war. He was imprisoned and has gone to jail for criticizing how the Russian leaders have been pursuing this war. And he is, of course, has some popularity among the people who are involved in the war. So there's been a lot of disunity and a lot of chaos. The war itself is restricted now to the eastern parts of Ukraine, and it's sort of in a stalemate. It's sort of in a trench war where both sides have dug down their heels. Not much is happening. If you look at the map of how the territories or occupied territories have moved, basically nothing has happened this whole year. So very little has happened in that respect. And so it's a terrible situation, sort of like World War I or something like that, where it's just a stalemate or a very locked position in the war. And both sides, it's the war is just grinding down people on both sides. So it's a terrible war. And the latest figures some of the figures, it's very difficult to have numbers of casualties, but they're up in several hundreds of thousands, 500,000, 600,000, with roughly equal numbers on both sides. It's very difficult to say exactly. On the Ukrainian side, it's also bad. Of course, the Ukrainians are experiencing war fatigue. The war is in Ukraine, so of course they're experiencing a lot of suffering because of that. It's their country that is experiencing the war. They had this attempt at a spring summer offensive to take back territory. I think that most people didn't really expect anything to come of that. I think it was mostly a sort of war propaganda to keep up morale, to keep people fighting. I don't think anyone really expected anything to happen, because they're up against massive fortifications on the Russian side, huge deep minefields. It's just impossible to make any advances in that kind of situation. So it's a very locked situation. And Zelensky's approval rating has gone down. It's still, still pretty high, but it's gone down from the 80s, in the 80% to the 60%. There's also been a little bit of disunity with respect to the war command and the government, where it's mostly been about how are we talking about the war, what terms are we using, because in a vulnerable situation like Russia, or like Ukraine is, they don't want to demoralize their people, because everyone is suffering, so they don't want to demoralize people. So there's been some bickering there, but nothing like, on the Russian side, where there was a direct mutiny attempt and you had Russians fighting Russians because there was that much chaos. And of course, as I expected when the war started, that the Western side or the Western NATO powers would sort of grow tired of the war, and especially America, I think, has a history of being interested in a war and then growing tired of it. I don't think that they can really abandon this war entirely, but I think that the interest in keeping on supplying Ukraine with military aid, I think that interest is going down. It's still, it's also still high, but it is going down. So, you know, if we're looking long term, there were some talk in the news in the last few days about Putin being willing to sort of freeze the conflict. That might be wishful thinking. I don't think there is any end in sight for the war. I think it will continue, but I don't think that anything big or dramatic will happen anytime soon. And also, if they would freeze the war or the conflict lines where they are now, Ukraine would essentially have to join NATO, because otherwise they would be looking at a potential other invasion, you know, within the next 10 years. And you can't really stop a war on those conditions. So I don't think that both sides are close enough to be able to come to any kind of agreement yet, unfortunately. I mean, everyone wants to see that war end. But I just don't see any end in sight. I mean, Russia has announced that they are going to increase military spending from 2023 to 2024 with 70%. So a 70% increase from this year to next year in military spending, which would signal that they're not going to end the war anytime soon. So this is just a war that's going to, unfortunately, probably drag on for a while. And we'll just have to see how it goes. But I don't really see any dramatic changes coming up anytime soon.
Obviously, everyone wants this war to be over, and everyone wishes that it had never happened, and everyone wants as many Ukrainians to survive and to be alive and healthy as possible. I mean, that should go without saying, but it's worth repeating. Because my position on this, as a complete layman, from the start was, I took a few weeks before I said anything, because I thought a number of people made fools of themselves with COVID and by speaking too soon. So I didn't want to make that mistake with Ukraine. Yeah. So I didn't say anything for about 3 or 4 weeks. And then I said, well, it looks like Ukraine can't possibly win this, even though I'd like them to, even though I've got nothing against them. It looks like just practically speaking, Russia is a much bigger country with a much bigger military, and it's going to win. So, given a long enough timeline, regardless of how it plays out, the end result is probably going to be that Russia wins to some way. Even if it doesn't get everything it wants, broadly speaking, that's what looks like is going to happen. And I think that everyone else saw that as well. And that's why all these other countries piled in to give military support, material to Ukraine. But it now looks like, I mean, the situation seems to be pretty bad. That Zelensky, his own advisors, his close circle have said to, I think it was Time magazine, that there's no way that they can win this. Apparently, a lot of the average army, the average age in the army is in 40, 45 now, because the young men are gone. I mean, that's horrendous. So what would you say to someone? Because there will be people, I haven't checked the live chat, but there will be people saying Ukraine should have surrendered at the start, and it would actually now be in a better condition than it is in.
Well, I mean, you could say that about anyone. You could say that about people in any conflict. But, I mean, Ukraine is not a tiny country. It's a poor country, which is one of the factors involved in why they're fighting this war. But it's not a tiny country that would just accept being pushed around. Russia has three times the population, roughly three times the population of Ukraine. Russia is also an enormous, a gigantic empire. And you can't just pour everyone into Ukraine because you have to keep up the entire country. And because when you have a big empire, it's surrounded by other countries, which of course will pounce on any weakness, right? So you have to deter the rest of the world entirely when you have a big empire like that. And so you can't really pour everyone into Ukraine. So the power relation isn't like 3-1, but it's definitely with respect to resources, Russia has more of its own weapons and so on. So they don't rely on outside help the same way that Ukraine does. So I think that is more important than the actual numbers, number of people living in the country. I think the supply of weapons is a crucial factor. Everyone expected, the war to end quicker, or that it would be more difficult even for Ukraine. When Russia invaded, basically they had this narrative that it would take them a few weeks to take Kiev and that would be the end of it. But that didn't happen. Everyone expected something along those lines, maybe not as quickly as the sort of the Russian rhetoric wanted to have it, but something along those lines. I think even America expected that to happen, because one of the sort of the myths or the sort of the disinformation narratives about the war is that Russia had to attack because America was, and the West and NATO was supplying Ukraine with weapons, so they became a dangerous neighbor to Russia, and so Russia had to attack. That's not true. Even when the war started, the West was reluctant to give too much weapons to Ukraine for several reasons. But one of the reasons is, of course, if Ukraine falls and they've sent all these weapons there, well, then those weapons are in Russian hands. So NATO was very reluctant at first. So they had a sort of a wait and see attitude. And it was only when the Ukrainians surprised everyone by being able to repel the Russian invasion that they started getting more and more and more military aid from NATO as well. So NATO has been increasing its military aid when they see, okay, well, maybe we can, you know, push more weapons in there because there is actually a sign of Ukrainian success. So I think that Ukraine performed much, much better than everyone expected at the start, because the, you know, Russian 2 weeks to flatten the country has now turned into 2 years and a stalemate. And they've basically been pushed back into the eastern territories where they were from, you know, 2014 to 2022, before the invasion. Of course, they have more territory now than before the invasion, but they're in the same region of the country. They've been repelled from Kiev and other parts and so on. So I think that in that respect, Ukraine performed better than everyone expected. And NATO has now been supplying Ukraine with arms so that they can resist the Russian invasion. What's going to happen from here, I don't know. But I don't really buy the argument that, well, there's no point in fighting because, I mean, you could say that about the Afghans. You can say that about the people in Gaza. You can always say that about a country that is smaller, that's being attacked by a bigger country, but people usually don't come with that argument. I think it's a somewhat disingenuous argument, because you could say that about anything. You could say that about, for example, people who are right-wingers. Well, I mean, what's the power relation between the globalist, cosmopolitan, progressive ruling class in the West and people like you, for example? Why don't you just shut down shop? I mean, that's not really a valid argument, because, of course, you would have some faith. I mean, and that power relation is much more gruesome than the power relation between Ukraine and Russia. I mean, the power relation between people like you and me and the globalist ruling class in the West is something like 1,000,000 to 1. And still we're here because we believe it's right. And with respect to Ukraine, it's pretty simple, really, what's going on here, because Ukraine was occupied. Russia occupied half of Europe 30 years ago. And what happened after that, after the Cold War, and after all these countries separated from the Soviet Empire, and they became independent countries, they wanted to join NATO because that was their security guarantee to not be invaded and attacked again. That's what they did. And what's happened is that, you know, countries in, for example, the Baltic states and other countries, they have prospered since they became free from that Soviet system and so on. Whereas Ukraine has remained very much a poor country, very much chaotic, very much corrupt, very much a part of that kind of post-Soviet culture. And I think that is what, if you talk to people in Ukraine, what is it that they want to get away from? It is that kind of corrupt post-Soviet heritage that they want to just become a normal European country. And so, you know, when they applied for NATO membership, that is what they wanted. They were rejected by NATO because NATO has been very reluctant about dealing with that whole situation. NATO doesn't really want Ukraine as a member because that would mean they would have to actually fight Russia. They don't want to fight Russia. They don't want a direct confrontation, right, like that. So the argument that, well, you should just give up as soon as someone bigger than you attacks, we don't apply that to any other situation, really. And so with respect to Ukraine, they just want to become like the other countries that were used to be occupied by Russia or the Soviet Union. And then, you know, there were even election or votes, referenda in these countries saying that, no, we don't want to be ruled by Russia. And that's why the Soviet Empire was dismantled, because these countries wanted their independence. And it was actually America that pressured Ukraine to give up their nuclear weapons, which were a sort of a security guarantee against Russia. And actually, John Mersheimer was one of the people who in 1994 said that we shouldn't pressure Ukraine to give up its nukes, because that's what they have to as a guarantee against the future Russian attempt to reoccupy the country. And so what they're fighting for is really, you know, I talk to a lot of Ukrainians, and they don't find, they don't want to live in Ukraine if they would have to be occupied by Russia, if they would have to live under those conditions. They want to be independent from that system. And it's not a language or ethnic or anything like that. It's a political system. I hear a lot of these arguments, which are kind of silly, that, people in Eastern Ukraine speak Russian. Well, yeah, I mean, Canadians speak English and Americans speak English. Does that mean that the U.S. should just occupy Canada because they speak the same language? No, it's not about which language they speak. Or people in Ireland, they've been fighting with England, you know, for independence. They speak English as well. It's not really about that. It's about what kind of country, what kind of political system and so on do you want? From the Russian point of view, Russia is an empire. They have to flex their muscles sometimes. I've made this comparison to, one of the pirates, one of the famous pirates. I forget his name, but he would go out and just shoot a random crew member just to keep them on their toes so that they wouldn't rebel. Right? Have a big empire, you sometimes have to put some fear into your neighbors to show that you still have some muscle. So Russia is acting rationally from its own perspective, because if you see all these other countries that used to be under the Russian umbrella or the Soviet umbrella, they're doing much better than Russia. And you see Ukraine, which was the biggest country that was ruled outside of Russia, the biggest country that was ruled by the Soviet Union, they also want to join these other countries, which are actually becoming more successful than Russia. That's an embarrassing thing, and it's sort of a risk, because, you know, when other countries start turning their back on you and they don't want to be your friends, they don't want to be part of what you're doing, that is a risk for an empire. That means that they risk falling apart. So I understand that the Russians felt that they had to step in and prevent Ukraine from leaving their orbit, because otherwise it's a bad look. It's not a nice look that the other countries are leaving you and they're doing better than they were under, you know, when they were your friends. So I can understand the motivations on both sides. They are rational, but what I sympathize with is, of course, Ukraine. I mean, I don't think it's reasonable to expect of other people that they should just live under conditions that we wouldn't accept just because, well, that would be nice for some abstract Russian power interests or something like that. These are real people living in a real country, and they want a chance of living in just a normal European country. That's what a lot of them think and want. And they don't want to go back to, or they don't want to become anything, you know, like Belarus or something like that, living under a Russian sort of power umbrella. They don't want that. And so what do you do? Well, there's a conflict, but we've already seen when the Soviet Empire fell apart that these countries didn't want to be ruled by Russia. That's why they left. And that's why they applied. They came knocking on, you know, there's always this rhetoric that NATO is expanding eastward. NATO is expanding in on Russia's border. No, these countries came and knocking on NATO's door. They wanted to be a part of that security alliance so that they wouldn't have to worry about being invaded by Russia. And so I think it's going to be very, I mean, what does it mean that Russia will win? These countries don't want to be ruled by Russia. I mean, Putin obviously clearly had this expectation when he invaded that to some extent, at least, he would be welcomed with open arms and flowers, you know, as liberator rather than occupier. That's not what happened. We can look at the actual events. That is not what happened. That is not what the Ukrainian people wanted, obviously. Otherwise, they wouldn't be fighting like this. It's a very difficult situation to say exactly what's going to happen, but just to claim that, well, there's a smaller countries, they should just surrender without a fight. That's a bizarre. We don't apply that to anything else.
I understand, obviously, that Ukrainians don't want to live under a foreign dictatorship. They don't want to be ruled by Russia. And of course, it's their country, it's their land, it's their heritage. So obviously they care about it. I think the claim is they could have protected these things better by negotiating with Putin at the start, because now they're in a position where huge numbers of their young men are dead, huge numbers of their young women have emigrated, so their population is decimated. At least their ability to reproduce is now greatly damaged. So they would actually be in a better position to face the future if they'd not done this. Now, I understand what you're saying. It's a horrible situation because, yeah, telling people to surrender is kind of sick. I just wonder if, practically speaking, they would have been in a better position now had they surrendered at the start. The other thing about, and it's a valid point you make, that we don't apply this to ourselves in the distant right, we don't apply it to the Palestinians. That's true, but the Palestinians are literally being ethnically cleansed. I mean, Putin is not saying we're going to wipe out the Ukrainian people. We're going to remove them from their homeland. All of the Ukrainians are going to go live in wherever else. So in that sense, it's not a life and death thing. The Ukrainians could have retained their country, or at least most of it, if they had surrendered. It could actually be that they end up losing more than they would have lost. Because Putin will just take it. And again, I'm not saying this because I'm a supporter or fan of Putin. I've got no reason to. But I think that is the argument being made. So I think it's only right that I present that to you, because otherwise, I don't want to let this just be unaddressed.
No, so I've heard that point. I've heard that claim, but it is just a claim. Of course, the Ukrainians know who they're dealing with. They have experience of it. And the fact is that the Russians are fighting this war in terms of what they call denazification, because they say the rhetoric is, that Russia, that Ukraine as such is a quote-unquote Nazi construction. It's a Nazi, that denazification means getting rid of it, incorporating it essentially into Russia. So it is, it's not, I agree with you, it's not ethnic cleansing in the same way that Israel is pursuing ethnic cleansing of Gaza, that is just, you know, murdering them or running them out. But it is ethnic cleansing in the same way that ethnic cleansing is going on in, for example, Western countries or other in countries where they say, you don't have a group identity, you don't have a separate identity, you don't have a separate nation, you are individuals or whatever, but you're not allowed to, you're not allowed to preserve your identity as Scottish. You're not allowed to preserve your identity as English or German or French or whatever, or Swedish. That is what's going on in the West. And that's also a type of ethnic cleansing, because that means that, you know, generations from now in the future, if we don't actually defend our identity as a separate group identity, then that identity will exist. There will be no more Scottish people if you're not allowed to actually pursue your identity as Scottish, because that's sort of what it is. And, you know, when people like former President Medvedev says that all of the territories of Ukraine are disputed, because there's this rhetoric that, oh, these territories in eastern Ukraine are disputed. No, all of Ukraine is disputed, he says. People like Dugin says clearly, repeatedly, again and again, as a form of sort of voice for a propaganda voice that is very much in favor of this war and is projecting it to the outside world. He says clearly and repeatedly, there will be no Ukraine when this war is over. He said it explicitly many times. And also you'll see the behavior of Russia when they have occupied territory. They incorporate it into, they say this is no longer Ukraine. This is no longer ruled by Ukraine. So that means the more territory they take, I mean, you have to sort of put these things together. What is the explicit claim by Putin that he wants to accomplish with this war? He says it's demilitarization and denazification. Denazification means that Ukraine is no longer allowed to have a separate identity, a separate national identity. People like Medvedev say all of Ukraine is disputed territory. People like Dugin and other leaders of Russia's intellectual leaders and ideologues and so on say that there will be no Ukraine when this war is over. And the actions. I mean, when you put all these things together, you have a pretty clear picture that the Ukrainians obviously think that if they don't fight this war, they will have no country anymore. They will have no country of their own, because that is explicitly what the Russians are saying to them.
Right. So in that sense, it is an existential struggle, and they are actually fighting to preserve, to save their country from dissolution.
I mean, that's how they see it. Yeah.
Someone's asked, what do you think about Gonzalo Lira, Coach Red Pill?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's an embarrassing character. I made fun of this, and you know, people like Tucker Carlson and so on, they sort of, oh, we're so surprised, how come this guy is persecuted? Is he persecuted? I mean, if he should you just be allowed to aid and abet an ongoing invasion of your host country? I mean, there's a reason why, for example, you know, the Americans put Japanese people in the concentration camps when they were fighting Japanese, because you're a security risk. It's obvious. I mean, this is a no-brainer. And the people who pretend, well, isn't there freedom of speech? No, there's no free speech when your country is being invaded and your existence is, I mean, that's a state of exception. I mean, it's a state of emergency. You cannot allow people to aid and facilitate an ongoing invasion of your country. Of course, that is going to be a crime. I mean, people pretend to be stupid to not understand this stuff. I mean, this is quite obvious. No country would accept it. Do you think that if Russia was invaded, that they would just allow fifth columnists to sort of support and propagandize in favor of the invasion of the country. No country would accept that. America wouldn't accept it. England wouldn't, Germany wouldn't, no country would accept it. I mean, these are sort of no-brainers. I mean, he was obviously a non-Ukrainian guest who overstayed his welcome. I mean, this is bizarre.
I completely agree. And I'm just surprised. I'm just baffled as to why he stayed and did this. I mean, if he wanted to preach against it and support the Russian side and all that, at least get out of Ukraine before you do that. It just seems insane. I don't know if he was sort of looking for a glorious, end to his life, like a sort of heroic jump over the cliff kind of thing. And not that he's dead now, I'm not saying that, but my point is, was he looking for some sort of glory by doing this? I just don't understand why else you would do this. I mean, it's very naive to think, well, I can do this and there won't be consequences. They'll just let me continue. The stuff he was saying was surprising even me. I remember at the time, I thought, what the hell does he think he's doing? Regardless of what position you take in the conflict, what he's doing is fucking mad. He should get out of the country. You can't. I mean, I'm very much against this idea of people speaking out against their host country, not just tourists or whatever you would say he was. Anyone who's not native to a country speaking against it while living there, should be punished. Ideally, yeah, they course. Should be ejected.
Of course.
But during a war, especially, I don't know. I just don't know what he was thinking.
No, I don't know what he was thinking either. I mean, I find him just a despicable, vulgar person with like just the most disgusting values. He's an embarrassing figure. But I think it's arrogance. I mean, he has an American passport. I guess that's the only reason why he's not dead now. I think the Ukrainians have shown more restraint than pretty much any other country would do under such circumstances with a sort of an agent provocateur during an invasion. I mean, you can just imagine people seeing their neighbors killed, their houses bombed, and you have this bizarre foreigner being there gloating about it and facilitating or aiding the invasion. Of course, they wouldn't accept that. I mean, most people would probably have shot him. I mean, it's probably only because he has an American passport, I guess, that he's not dead. I think the Ukrainians have shown more restraint than anyone would expect under such circumstances.
Yeah. I don't know if there's much else to say about the Ukraine conflict. Someone's saying he tried leaving, but it was too late. But that's after he was first, as I understand it, that was after he had first spoken out against the war and so forth. So I don't think that's the case. He was arrested first, I don't know when. Then they let him out, and then that was when he wasn't allowed to leave, because I think they envisaged that they were going to put him on trial later on. So, that's what happened. I don't know. It just seemed mad to me. Someone said that he did it for social media. Yeah, maybe, but I think he must
maybe,
have.
Maybe, I don't know.
He can't have been unaware that it was going to be bigger than that. It wasn't. He was endangering his life.
Of course.
By doing this. So I don't think it was just for social media plaudits. I think it was a sort of lust for some sort of glory. But again, I'm psychologizing there. Who knows? Who knows what someone else is motivated by? I really don't know. Okay, so there were some questions. Oh, and Not Finished said, the heavyweights are on. Have been looking forward to this. Thank you. Mention Moldbag said, do you think a weakening economy and high interest rates will restrict white flight, forcing people to confront mass immigration?
High interest rates and a tanking economy would stop white flight? Probably to some extent. If people cannot afford to move, they will not do it. And what's happening now, I think, is we're seeing something along those lines that, a lot of people in the West have wanted to move to, for example, Eastern Europe. Eastern European prices are now almost equally high as Western European prices. It's not sort of, okay, well, we can sort of get out of this over bourgeois, over civilized mess, because it's, you know, the economy or the prices and so on are rising in Eastern Europe as well and so on. So, but what I'm trying to say is that I think that we're slowly running out of places to flee to. And a part of it is economy. A part of it is what we said there about interest rates and so on. I think we're running out of places to flee to. So yeah, I think that a thing like white flight for practical reasons is gonna slow down, because what can you do? There's no place left to run to. You know, that's the, and this has been a deliberate policy of the sort of cosmopolitan progressive ruling class, that they want, for example, mass immigration and so on. You want it everywhere. If you go to Sweden, you will see people, non-Swedish people, being, you know, sitting in the extreme cold in, you know, the pole, you call it the polar circle, north of the polar circle, where like the sun doesn't rise in the winter. That's not a natural choice. This is something that is sort of, this is a policy that our ruling class, they want this situation everywhere. And so we're going to run out of places to flee to. That's just a natural thing. So yeah, I guess I answer the question in the affirmative, which might be a good thing, because then people will have to take it more seriously. Not that it's very easy to flee anyway, because, you know, people don't want to, you know, pick up all their things and move away because they have friends and family and so on. So it's a difficult thing. It's not an easy way out, but I think that hole is slowly but surely being plugged.
Yeah, it's a big thing. I think in a country like Britain especially, there just aren't places to flee to. I think people thought for a long time that this village or that remote city like Aberdeen will be white forever. But really within a few decades, that has been complete, well, even less. That has been completely disproven. You can go to rural Scotland, and even already there's a heavy presence of non-white people. So yeah, it's not actually a big challenge for the powers that be to scatter when they have such huge numbers of people coming in. They can easily sprinkle them all over the country very thinly. There's no shortage. So it's happening. And that means that there are really no places left to flee to in Britain. White flight is probably a phenomenon of the past. I think it's probably something that people did between the 80s and 2010s. And that's it. But obviously in America, I'm sure it's quite different. I'm sure there are still many places that, you know, the white picket fence and so on. But even there, you know, in a decade or two, it'll be everywhere. So I think this is something that that large section of white people, and it must be a huge percentage of them, who simply don't want to confront this or talk about this, are gradually going to be forced to, or they're just going to have to admit, okay, it's done, it's over, or they're going to have to put up a fight. But the idea of deluding themselves about it, it is going to be increasingly impossible. Okay, Black Pigeon Pill said, please congratulate Frode on organising the Skanza Forum in Tallinn, Estonia, earlier this year. It was a pleasure for my brother and me meeting you, and we wish you both you and Woz a Merry Christmas and every success in 2024. That's nice. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
And he says, please ask Frode his thoughts on the significance of the North, specifically its connotations to Hyperborea, and the esoteric, magical aspects often associated with it. Good Yule again, guys. Thank you. You've asked very, very big question.
It is a big question. I think it is. I mean, you know, there's sort of a mythological aspect to it. I think that there's also sort of a biological aspect to it and scientific aspect to it. I think that, I mean, Kevin MacDonald, he's argued that the special character of Northwestern Europeans especially has a lot to do with, well, of course, cold climate. If you go through cold winters And we're talking about, you know, hundreds of years, thousands of years ago. If you go through cold winters and you don't put away any food and you just, you're impulsive, so you just eat everything in the summer, then you're going to die in the winter. So people with a low impulse control and so on, they died. And so we had a selection process where you practice a more sort of long-term thinking, long-term planning and so on, which automatically breeds success. Of course, also intelligence. It's more difficult to survive in that kind of climate. You have to deal with harsh realities all the time. It's very difficult. But also, it's not a very densely populated area, especially Scandinavia during the Ice Age and so on. So you had people scattered over a very large area, which meant that they had to be very self-reliant, which also created contributed to a sort of a very individualist mindset where we judge people more on their character than their tribal belonging, which tribe they belong to. And so people are judged by their moral character. You have all these factors which are connected with the North because, of course, the Middle East and other places have been more densely populated. So you're dealing with completely different natural selection or different factors of natural selection, which create a different mentality, different culture, different people biologically as well. So I think that that is one of the things. And also, I think that there is a sort of an adventurous spirit in the Nordic. Maybe we're getting into more of a mythological, but it's also, I mean, it's just a fact that if you look at who were the big explorers in the world, who, created maps of Asia and explored the North Pole, the South Pole, and so on. It's pretty much Northwestern Europeans, at least Europeans. We see this sort of Nordic kind of spirit that wants to explore and is very adventurous and seeks out difficulty. I mean, I have friends who I've talked to, and we've often played with the idea that we've become too comfortable. So we've created this mess around us to have something difficult to deal with, some difficult problem to solve, because we've basically solved everything else. We live in total comfort. So now we need some difficult thing to deal with. And that's why we're in this situation on a sort of subconscious level. But the point is that I think we thrive. We need struggle and adventure and so on. I think that there are differences between different groups and mentalities. Some people are satisfied with just relaxing and having a nice time and so on. I think we get bored by that. We need some kind of adventure and some big challenges.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's what makes life meaningful for us. I think without that, life seems meaningless.
Yeah.
So, okay. Not Finished, and there are quite a few questions about Ukraine. Not Finished says, a lot of the pushback from Russians with regard to the Ukraine situation has been about their gloves-on status, i.e. special military operation, instead of going full gloves off, a declaration of war. This was Prigozhin's pushback also. I don't know if you've got anything to say about that.
I mean, we can always speculate, you know. I mean, people like Prigozhin, people like even Alexander Dugin, people like Strelkov, Igor Girkin, who is now, you know, being persecuted by the Russian leaders, they have criticized the Russian war command for not pursuing the war in the right way. But who knows how much is, you know, limitations from what resources they actually have, what they can do, and how much is, you know, are they... You know, I've heard this argument. Oh, they're holding back. Oh, they're holding back. They deliberately just dropped, you know, hundreds of thousands of casualties of their own people and put themselves in this situation. I don't buy that. I think that there are more bigger limits because, like I said, when we started talking, they've replaced their war command several times, which means that things are not going. They're not happy with how things are going. And I think that maybe it's because of external circumstances. Maybe they could have made better decisions. I mean, I don't really know. So it's very difficult. It's always hypothetical, you know, when people are sort of backseat drivers and say that, well, you should have done this differently. I don't know if they could have, you know. So it's very difficult to evaluate such criticism.
Yeah. Homa Talk says, I might not agree entirely with Frode's take on Ukraine, but I agree completely with all of his movie reviews. So I guess it's a wash. Merry Christmas, guys. Well, thank you, Homer Talk.
Merry Christmas.
Okay, we'll go back to the... I'll read out these questions in the order that they came in. Jez says, why would you like Ukraine to win this war? Its government is a US-installed pro-homo load of a certain tribe who wanted to join NATO, thereby provoking Russia. What remains of Ukraine will be one of the most paused countries in Europe. Winning would be bad for the Ukrainians, just like winning World War II was bad for the British.
Well, I don't take arguments like that seriously. If Ukraine has a bad government, okay. Well, presumably, I don't know where this viewer is from, which country he's from. Let's say he's English. Let's say he's English and he is a right winger. Let's say he's unhappy that England has a prime minister, or UK has a prime minister called Rishi Sunak. Okay, does that mean we should carpet bomb London and burn down British towns because there happens to be a mayor in London that we don't like, or that England has a prime minister that we're unhappy with? Should we just carpet bomb? I mean, this is bizarre. Why would they accept an invasion just because they have a government they disagree with? This is the nature, unfortunate fact of quote-unquote democratic system, that sometimes you have one kind of government, sometimes you have one other, and you're maybe not ever going to be happy about them. Are you just going to accept other countries attacking you and invading you because of that? I mean, this is a bad argument. It's not a serious argument. And again, it's an argument that no one would apply to any other country or any other situation. It's not a serious argument.
All right. Somebody, Magic Man, says Putin's invasion of Ukraine is just like Hitler's invasion of Poland, totally justified due to atrocities against his people in the territory. So this would be about Germans being brutalized in Poland and Russians being brutalized in Ukraine. What would you say about that?
No, this is the opposite. Germany was chopped up at the end of the First World War at the Versailles Treaty. Everyone at the time saw that this is not going to last. This is going to be a bad situation. So Germany was chopped up against its will as sort of a punishment from other countries, forcing them to this situation. And Hitler wanted to retake territories that, you know, people in Germany wanted to belong to Germany, and the people who lived there and so on. I mean, this is a country that was chopped up as a punishment. When the Soviet Union was dismantled, the people in those territories, they literally voted to separate from the Soviet Union. It was the Soviet leaders themselves that made the decision. So it wasn't imposed on them from the outside. It's the opposite of what happened in Germany. It's a complete opposite. I mean, if Putin wants to blame anyone, he can't blame the quote-unquote Nazis in the West and the Anglo-Saxons and all this delusional stuff. He has to blame, his predecessors, the rulers of the Soviet Union who made the decision. But the point is that this has now been going on for 30 years. They've lived in this country. They've created their own country, and they're pursuing their own interests. And now to say, no, you know what? We changed our mind. We're just going to attack you and occupy these territories and incorporate you. I mean, it's not the same situation as Germany at all. It's completely the opposite, really.
All right. And then Open Borders says, the Millennial Festival and the Guide to Culture Film Festival, Decameron, are the two best dissident right festivals on the internet. May they continue for many years. Well, thank you very much. Orthanc Powered says, Millennial and Decameron ended up back-to-back this year by accident, I think. Well, not quite back-to-back. There was a gap of about 2 weeks, I think, after you finished. But yeah, broadly.
Almost
back-to-back.
A month, yeah.
Yeah. Back-to-back this year by accident, I think. But there must be audience crossover, and I can't be the only one who really liked one starting right after the other ended. Is it logistically possible for you and Frode to make that a yearly tradition? Thank you. Well, you know, I've been pressuring Martin Lichtmes to do a horror film thing for around Halloween. But I don't, and that would be ideal, because that would even bridge the gap. between Decameron and Millennial. But he doesn't seem to want to do it, which is a damn shame, because I think he'd be the perfect guy to do a horror film thing. But yeah, Frody, this year, Decameron being later in the year was an accident, but are you going to maintain that in the future or revert to the springtime?
Exactly. It was an accident because, well, when the Cameron Film Festival started, we started when the lockdown started, which was in April, March, April. It started in March, but we did the festival in April because we had to organize it. So, it took a few days. It took a couple of weeks to set it up the first time. So that's why it ended up in April, first of all. But now I had a conflicting event because I had a conference and other things to organize in the spring. So I couldn't have the Cameron in the spring. I had to move it to the fall. I think it's much better suited to the fall. It's autumn time because people like to watch films in the autumn. So it's a cozy time of the year. People like to watch films, to talk about films. So I think it's much more suitable. So if I'm able to continue the Cameron Film Festival, I would like to keep it in the autumn. I think it's just a more suitable season for it.
Yeah, I do agree. I mean, it started in the spring, really, as you say, because of circumstances. Everyone was suddenly in the springtime, trapped indoors. So it made sense.
Exactly.
But yeah, I think in general, autumn is a better time for this kind of thing. Okay, and then Open Borders said, is anyone scared at the sheer number of people in the third world? This must have been to do with my earlier comment. Steve Saylor showed the world's most important graph of 4.5 billion Africans by the year 2100. Even though we think we have high numbers of immigrants at the moment, compared to their actual numbers, it's actually a drop in the ocean. Well, it's a terrifying prospect. And there are people, globalist leaders, that awful guy from Bono's foundation, I think it's the One Foundation, saying there will be tens of millions of Africans coming in every year in the near future into Europe, flooding into Europe. And this is a good thing. It's an appalling clip from this guy from about 5 years ago where he just talks about, and he's Irish, but he doesn't sound Irish. And he's in the Irish Parliament, saying this stuff, saying that Ireland will be demographically replaced. And he says it's a good thing because we are senescent. We are old populations, aging populations. So it'll be good to get this youthful African vigor. He doesn't use that phrase, but that's what he means. Into Europe. And I just think it sounds like hell on earth. It sounds like the worst thing you could possibly wish for European countries. But for these people, it seems to be a fairly sincere desire. I think in at least some of them, they really do believe in equality. They really do believe that everyone's the same. They really do believe that hundreds of millions of Africans need and deserve and should get a chance for a better life. And of course, it doesn't occur to them that once enough of them are here, it won't be a better life for them anymore anyway, because it will just be Africa, just with colder climate. They're completely delusional. And then, of course, I think there are others who absolutely know damn well the effect that it will have, and they want it. So, yeah, the numbers are staggering. Of Africans, and it's because of Western aid efforts. Well, Live Aid would obviously be a key event there, but it was going on before then. And indeed, even during the 21st century, the 20th century, the population of Africa skyrocketed. I believe it's also true of the 19th century when we were oppressing them, that we were actually helping more and more of them to live and to reproduce and to have kids. So there are ever more Africans. And this is what happens. This is the only thing that happens when you create more Africans, is that you end up with yet more Africans. And that's really the only effect. the numbers now, after all of this endless Western help to them, the aid, all of that, The end result is that the numbers are absolutely huge and on an upward trend, so that, as you say, 4.5 billion by the year 2100, by the end of the century. So, I mean, it's if we want Europe to survive, everyone knows what's going to have to be done. The gates are going to have to be absolutely closed. Mass deportations probably are going to have to happen. It's the only way that life as we know it, and as our parents and grandparents and great-grandparents knew it, and as our children currently know it, can possibly continue. If they stay here and if the numbers keep pouring in, life as we know it is simply over. Culture as we know it is over. The economy as we know it is over. Civilization as we know it is over. And the West is over. It's really that stark.
I don't think it's going to happen. I think this is turning very quickly now. I even see the Swedish establishment admitting the entire, I mean, just as one example, I see the entire Swedish establishment basically admitting that mass immigration was a disaster, and they're sort of blaming each other. The sort of, if we're talking about left of center bloc, right of center bloc, they're sort of saying, we saw this coming, you didn't. And the other says, no, I saw this coming, you didn't see it coming, you were naive. And it's like, no, none of you said anything, but everyone is seeing it now. No one supports this. I think a lot of this rhetoric is hollow and empty now. Yes, you brought up some examples of the sort of fanatics in Irish Parliament and so on. I don't think that they're representative of larger numbers of people anymore. I think that this narrative is falling apart. Everyone can see in their day-to-day life that this doesn't work. You can sort of fool people, you can manipulate people when they're not confronted with this reality every single day of their life, but you know they don't listen to it anymore. They've shut down the sort of mass media narrative and so on. I think that this is going to shift. You know, within 10 years, I think there's going to be a very different attitude about these things, even in the sort of big mainstream and so on. And I think that a lot of what we're seeing now by big players, sort of somewhat conservative people like the Trump phenomenon is an attempt from the establishment. I'm not talking about a sort of a conspiracy theory that everyone sat down around a table and talked about how do we deal with this. But I think that this is an attempt from the establishment to somehow deal with the massive popular dissatisfaction with what's going on. So they're going to have to deal with it, and they can't just, you know, keep the lid on because it's the cat is out of the bag. They can't continue, and they're not going to just allow, you know, billions of Africans to come in. I don't think that's going to happen, because I think that, even the ruling class is slowly but surely going to see that, okay, we have to do something about it.
I mean, even if they don't want to, I think they're going to have to, because I don't see the public in general remaining peaceful for long. If what happened in Dublin a month ago, what's happened all over Germany ever since 2015, and Sweden, of course, what's happened in Rotherham towns all over England for a year. If this keeps happening, eventually there just isn't going to be a civil contract anymore. There just isn't going to be harmony anymore. There just isn't going to be the rule of law anymore. It's going to dissolve. And the question, I think, is whether the powers that be can install a police state fast enough. I mean, you can say in some ways they've already got a police state. The police follow orders. They do what they're told. But the question is, can they do that? Will they continue doing that when the reality is just of what they're doing and what they're defending, what they're maintaining, is so obvious to them that it's hideous. Will they continue? Will the police stay reliable? And I suspect that they won't.
No.
After a certain point. So the powers that be would have to install some other system, perhaps largely staffed by Africans themselves, actually policing the natives of Europe, which would be absolutely grotesque. But I also don't think it would work. I think you'd get militias of Europeans just fighting and easily trouncing these Africans. So it's not. I don't think that's going to happen. But I do think that the transition back to sanity is going to be dreadful. And this is what people like Frode and myself and many others have been warning about for decades. It's obvious. This couldn't succeed. The attempt couldn't continue forever. And the reversion to sanity was always going to be awful. But this is what our ruling class have brought upon us all.
Yeah, I mean, you can install a police state, but it only lasts so long and then it falls apart because it's hollow. It's the Soviet Union as a sort of a police state, but people didn't believe in it. People paid lip service for a while because, well, they were, yeah, that's how it works. But it fell apart. They didn't actually believe in it. They didn't contribute. And I think they might try. I mean, there's always, you could go, you know, full on dystopian and say, well, they will have AI controlling this and they will have, you know, drones and robots just killing everyone who doesn't comply. I don't think that's going to happen. You know, they're not going to have robots patrolling the streets, even though that might be a cool dystopia, but I don't think that's going to happen. You know,
because, 209, yeah.
You know, because here's the thing. There isn't like this monolithic conspiracy. The people at the top are also people. And when they see things happening, they sort of, well, you know, it's like, have you seen this, the German film, The Life of Others, the agent who is like listening in on phone conversations
Yes, I know about it. The actor died just very shortly after, if I'm correct. But yeah, I know of the film.
Yeah, the point is that, yeah, this sort of the security service man who was very loyal, very zealous and so on, he like, what the hell am I doing? And so the thing is that these are people as well. And not all of them are sociopaths. Not all of them are part of this, like, you know, Alex Jones, satanic cult. No, these are people who are pursuing a career and so on. And most of them aren't evil people. They're just doing what they're doing because they get rewarded for it and they're doing a job. And so that's why these kinds of massive dystopias, even if they sometimes happen, they tend to fall apart because the people in the system who are needed for keeping it working, they don't believe in the system anymore. And we're quickly reaching the point where even the people maintaining the system don't believe in the system anymore. And that's what I was talking about, for example, in my spring conference. I talked about there is this massive crisis of legitimacy in the ideology that is ruling the progressive cosmopolitan West now because they are working against the values that they claim that they represent. They claim that they are for an open society with liberal individual values and so on. No, they're not. They have a more of a, like a fanatical Soviet communist, pretty brutal ideology, like we've seen, for example, with the sort of memory holding of books and so on. This is a totalitarian, authoritarian ideology. This is not a liberal ideology. They say that they're liberal, but they're the opposite of liberal. They say that they're democratic. They are trying to get rid of democracy. The rulers of the American regime is trying to get rid of Trump. Trump is leading the election polls. He is leading over Biden at the moment, and they're trying to get rid of him. That's the opposite of democracy. The AfD, which is this sort of populist anti-mass immigration party in Germany, they're growing in the polls. They're the biggest opposition party in Germany. And the German state, oh, what are we going to do? Well, we have to get rid of them. Okay, so you get rid of the opposition. That's not democracy. That's the opposite of democracy. So you're doing the opposite of what you're claiming that you're doing. They say another example that I gave is, you know, from Francis Fukuyama, who is a sort of this ideologist of the sort of American establishment, I guess we can call him. He says that, well, our goal is to get to Denmark. We're going to make every country into basically Denmark. And that means low crime, low corruption, high trust, high functioning sort of civil society and so on. No, they're doing the opposite of that. They're not turning the third world into Denmark. They're turning Denmark into the third world. So they're doing the opposite of what they claim. And when this becomes apparent and obvious to everyone, then there is a massive crisis of legitimacy, because they are saying, literally, they're saying that these are the things that give us legitimacy. We are violating everything that gives us legitimacy. And so people will just stop believing in it. And so, yeah, I mean, if you, as long as you don't believe, you know, in some sort of conspiracy where everyone is a part of a satanic cult, which is rubbish, there are people and they believe in their own, you know, bullshit, basically, but they're going to stop believing in it. And so that's how things change.
Yeah, what you say there about Denmark and the Third World is interesting, because it reminds me of in the 70s, there was a theory in education. I don't know where it originated, probably America, but it was definitely very big in Britain. There was a theory that if you mixed children of different abilities together, the less intelligent kids will learn from the more intelligent kids, and so it will improve them. But what actually happened was that everything had to go down to the level of the unintelligent kids. So the more intelligent kids were hampered by the less intelligent. That was actually the way things reverted to the lowest common denominator. They did not rise to the highest. And I think in a similar way, when you import the third world, basically you turn into the third world.
Yeah.
And we've found that. It's common. It's exactly what happened in education. And it's exactly what's happening in multiculturalism. And common sense would have told you this. You cannot make less bright kids more bright. You can't. Maybe breast milk, I don't know, maybe better nutrition. But basically, it's locked in by the genes. So the same is true when it comes to populations as well, unfortunately. So that's that. Okay, and then the next question, we haven't even got to talk about Gaza yet, so but we will do that. Okay, so yeah, Privileged Shitlord said, Scythians unite, thank you. And then Noticer-in-Chief said, Decameron and Millennial are highlights of the year. Thanks to both of you. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, and then I'll ask you about the other big event of this year, which was indeed... Well, okay, there's another question. Yeah, there are a couple here. Not Finished said, thanks, gentlemen. Merry Christmas. Have a good 2024. Thank you. Blunderbuss asks if he can send you a donation on Entropy, Frody.
Yes, he can.
Yes.
It's the same. Well, I can put out the link afterwards. It is, let me just see here, Entropy. It is, it's just /GTK is the address for my Entropy. So yeah, just the extension is GTK. You just go to Entropy Live and whatever, entropystream.live /GTK.
Okay, I'll put that in here because it's just the same as mine, but it's got GTK at the end. There you go. All right. Okay, mention Moldbag. What culturally has been most damaging to us as far as movies and books are concerned? That's an interesting question. He goes on, is it the subversion of the hero narrative? Stories used to have a hero defending his people against an outside threat. Newer stories, like To Kill a Mockingbird, for example, show the heroic action to be defending the outsider from an ignorant cohort of his own people. I think this is the core of what is wrong with white people. Perhaps we need stories of new heroes. What would you say to that, Frody? Very different type of question.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, to just pick one trope or one characteristic in entertainment that has been disastrous, I think probably the mocking of masculine values. For example, I mean, even in the 1980s, we had sort of masculine heroes. That doesn't exist anymore. Now everyone is soft. Now everyone is is feminized. And if you get rid of heroic values and everyone just becomes nihilistic and everything is just about fun and nothing is about self-sacrifice and doing the masculine things, well, you're not gonna last. If everything is just about entertaining yourself to death, then society is gonna collapse. People lose their own self-respect. You know, there are things worse than death, and the kind of nihilism that we have. Even if you get all the sort of the physical pleasures and all of that, if you don't have some virtues like telling the truth or like bravery, standing up for what you believe in or standing up for whatever, it really saps the value out of life. So I think that getting rid of heroism is something that's mocked, and it's been mocked by Hollywood for a long time. People like Charlie Chaplin or whatever. Oh, they're goose stepping the army, the fighters, the warriors. Oh, they're just silly people who like fighting and so on. No, I mean, these are the people defending your country. So the sort of getting rid of thumos as a virtue, I think, is probably the worst trope in popular culture.
All right. With that, well, there is another one, but hold on a second. Yeah, I would have a lot to say about this, but not off the cuff. It's a difficult question, so I'll just leave it at that.
I would probably also give a different answer if I got time to think about it, but right here and now, that's sort of what comes to mind.
Yeah. But thank you for the super chat. Oliver asks, guys, maybe the future of Europe depends on one question. If Europe imports the Third World, do you genuinely believe mass repatriation of the Third World will happen? Oh, I don't know about that. I don't know how it will happen, how it will take place. But and I'm not even certain that it will happen. But I would hope, one way or another, that the population, the native peoples of Europe, will tire of this situation and reverse it one way or another. It might well get to the point where the governments of Europe realize that they have to reverse it, because otherwise their countries are going to be ungovernable and their populations are going to rebel in a very big way. So I'm not saying that it's going to happen, and I'm not saying how it's going to play out. I don't know. But I would certainly hope that this will happen. One way or another, I do think that the endless flooding of our countries with foreigners has to end, and probably will end, if for no other reason, just because it's so obvious what's going on. I mean, you cannot deny the Great Replacement at this point. If you do, you are obviously lying through your teeth, and everyone knows it. Frody?
Yeah, I think the acceptance of mass immigration and just open borders and just we're going to help and save the world, I think that's going to end pretty soon. I think the big question is, will our people have the moral steadfastness to reverse it? It's going to be easy to convince people that, you know what, we need to stop mass immigration. We need to stop all this stuff. And, you know, this ambition to save the entire world and be sort of world saviors and this messianic mission, we need to stop that. That's going to be an easy sell. The difficult thing is to say that, well, over the last 40, 50 years, we brought in millions of people. They need to be sent home.
It hasn't quite worked out.
Yeah. That's going to be a big hurdle. I think that, you know, it is possible and it is desirable to do that in a orderly, humane fashion by creating incentives for reversing this process. But there's going to be a fact, there's going to be a situation where a lot of people don't want to leave. And then the question is, will the government have the moral steadfastness to say, and to force them to say, you're going to have to leave. We're going to revoke your citizenship. That's going to be a difficult one. So I think that there are two problems. One is stopping further mass immigration and so on. But then reversing what's already happened, I think that's going to be a pretty, that's going to be a hurdle, because people are very squeamish. They're not very practical. They don't have the Benjamin Netanyahu mentality, which we can get into, because that's pretty much what they're doing in a pretty ruthless way. I think we would be pretty much more humane about this situation, but they have a different they have some of the mentality that is actually needed in a life and death situation. As brutal as the Israelis are, they have something about them that I kind of find admirable.
I can understand what you mean there. Ruins in the Landscape said, Merry Christmas, and give a generous donation. So thank you very much for that. Tower of Bones says, love both of you gentlemen. What do you guys think of American Christianity reconnecting itself to a European identity through orthodoxy? Well, neither Frode nor I is a Christian, so you'd really be better asking someone who is. Frode, do you have any opinion about this? Do you want to say anything about this?
I don't think I have a very good comment right now. And American Christians reconnecting with some sort of Orthodox church. For most Americans, I don't think that there is any Orthodox church to reconnect with, because most Americans came from Protestant countries and Catholic countries, not from countries that, you know, that have an Orthodox tradition. And so, you know, trying to convert to some sort of Eastern Orthodox religion as if that's going to give you some sort of connection to your ancestors when your ancestors were never Orthodox, I don't think that works. But that's a whole other topic. It's a big topic, and I think we don't really have time to get into it now.
No, we need to talk about Gaza. Thin Red Line also said, Merry Christmas, happy Yuletide to all pro-white people out there. Thank you very much, Thin Red Line. He's been a very loyal viewer throughout Millennial this year. It's much appreciated. So, Frode, Gaza. Someone said that I sound like I'm talking about the football player from the Italia 1990. Sorry about that. I don't know how else to pronounce the word Gaza. This has obviously been a thing that came at the end of the year, 7th of October. A lot of us were quite taken by surprise by it. I personally don't think the Israelis were. What do you think of the immediate attack by Hamas and the counterstrike by Israel and the global repercussions thereof?
Yeah, that is a big issue. I've talked about it on my weekly the weekly roundup, the weekly news commentary show that I do every Tuesday. Devoted a lot of time to talking about Gaza and Israel. And one of the major effects is that, well, there's a big difference between Europe and America here when it comes to public opinion about Israel. Europeans tend to be very sympathetic to Palestinians and their victimization by the Israelis. Americans, for pretty obvious reasons, are more sympathetic to the Israelis. There's a lot of sort of Christian Zionists, there's a lot of sort of Christian fanatics, but also simply that the Israel lobby is extremely powerful in America and influencing American foreign policy. So that's just how it is. And a lot of influential Jews in American mass media, so that it stands to reason that that's why America is more supportive of Israel. That's really changed. We saw some polls, for example, on CNN showing that, well, in older people, the majority is very much in favor of supporting Israel. And young people, Zoomers and so on, is like something like 25% in favor of Israel. It's very much against Israel. I think there are many reasons for that. One reason is that, you know, in 2012, I think it was, that of Americans born, it was a white minority. So already in 2012, the babies born in America were majority not white. So those people are going to have very different sensibilities and very different sympathies. You have to have a different kind of thing to appeal to their interests. They're also not going to be guilt-tripped by things like the Holocaust and the Second World War and so on. And they're also, Zoomers are also extremely nihilistic. I mean, I don't want to beat up on Zoomers, but they've grown up, and it's not their fault, but they've grown up in an extremely nihilistic culture. And they don't care. You're not going to guilt trip them into much of anything, I think. I mean, they've learned how to game the system by saying that, well, I have these and that, those pronouns. But at the same time, I don't think that they... I think they're pretty callous when it comes to caring about other people or other people's causes and so on. So I think there are many reasons, but also just, I mean, anyone can see the brute force that Israel is using against Palestinians. The Palestinians, Gaza is, you know, a lot of people just describe it as a big concentration camp. This is a secluded, closed off territory where people are living under sort of prison-like conditions. And they have no freedom, and their only way to fight back is through these kinds of acts of desperation. Is it effective? Does it work? No, I don't think so. But the Israeli response is to ethnically cleanse 2 million people out of that territory and say that, well, we don't want them in our country. You got to take them. A lot of people don't find that a very sympathetic thing to do. And... So one of the big effects, excuse me, one of the big effects is that sympathy with Israel has gone down, not only in Europe, but also in America, because people don't find this very appealing. Another thing to mention about this is that you will find far better information if you go directly to Israeli media than you will find in Western media, typically speaking. One of the things that Israeli media writes about very explicitly, very openly, is the fact that the Palestinian side was attempting to get a two-state solution through sort of as peaceful means as possible. The Israeli state, Israel and Benjamin Netanyahu, openly supported Hamas to undermine the Palestinian attempt to create a two-state solution, because Israel does not want a two-state solution. Israel wants all of it to themselves. They want to run the Palestinians out, or the Gazans out. And so they literally created this situation by supporting Hamas to undermine the Palestinian leaders. So they supported Hamas, and Hamas created or came up with this attack, and Israel is now using that attack as a pretext to ethnically cleanse 2 million people out of Gaza. And they do like bizarre things. They're gonna pull out big pumps to pump seawater into the tunnels to drown everyone who is hiding. They're just bombing and they're just killing. And one of the interviews from CNN with an IDF, that is the Israel Defense Forces, spokesman said that, well, we kill... One of the things that I should add is also that the average age in Gaza is very low, so a lot of children. So when they talk about civilians killed, it's mostly kids. And he said that we kill 2 civilians per 1 Hamas fighter. And these are tremendously positive numbers. So this man said, explicitly used those words, tremendously positive. This is a tremendously positive number that we kill 2 essentially kids or women for every Hamas fighter. Those are just admirable. This is just a narrative around Israel that's falling apart. They're calling Hamas terrorists. Well, Israel had 2 prime ministers who were leaders of terrorist organizations. The organization is Irgun, the organization the Stern Gang, called Lehi, people who assassinated UN leaders like Folke Bernadotte, who is a member of the Swedish royal family. They committed terror attacks against the King David Hotel, the British headquarters, and Palestine, Israel at the time, and those leaders of those terrorist organizations became the prime ministers of Israel. And just the rhetoric is completely bizarre that they're using here. And so, you know, and I think that the world is just seeing that, okay, this conflict doesn't live up to any standards that we are supposed to accept in any other context at all. It's just the Israelis have carte blanche to do whatever they want. And one of the effects is also that I think a lot of Western Jews want to wash their hands of people like Benjamin Netanyahu, because there have been massive protests in Israel. Like I said, Israeli media is very honest and very open about these things. So there's been massive, massive protests in Israel. There's also been a lot of criticism by Western Jews against Israel. So even among Jews, Israel, at least the Israeli regime, Israeli government, and Benjamin Netanyahu and so on, have lost a lot of sympathy even among Western Jews. And I think the West in general has been very lukewarm. Even America, the Biden government, has been pretty lukewarm in its support for Israel in comparison to previously.
Yeah, it's actually surprising. I was expecting, especially because we know how Jewish Biden's cabinet is, I thought it would be more vocal in support. It's surprising. Again, it seems to signal a sea change going on here.
Yes, 100%.
So sorry I interrupted you there. But what you said about Zoomers, how they don't care about the Holocaust and so on, reminded me of this meme. Because the thing is, this has become ever more relevant because Israel's counterstrike has been brutal, it's been vicious. Yeah. And then when they invoke the Holocaust, as they do, they say, well, this is why we've got to do this. It just doesn't wash anymore. And so you get memes like this one coming up, which I think does indicate the Zoomer mentality, but also increasingly other age groups as well. We've heard this stuff too many times now. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, and I think especially, you know, people start wondering, okay, so you, I mean, I'm talking about Israel, you are the ones keeping Palestinians in essentially a concentration camp. You are the ones pursuing ethnic cleansing, explicitly ethnic. I mean, they say this, we should drive them out. A mayor in one of the Israeli cities said, we should just flatten Gaza and turn it into an Auschwitz museum. He literally said that. That's in the Jerusalem Post. You can go look for it. That's what he said. That's their attitude. And so when essentially again, we concentrate.
To everyone else, this just seems like, when are you going to stop going on about this? For God's sake, it's 80 years ago. And I'm not even trying to, you know, for legal purposes, I should say, I'm not trying to diminish it or deny it or anything. I'm just saying it's 80 years ago. Other things have happened in the meantime. A lot has happened in the meantime. In everyone's country, where there's Swedish women being raped, Rotherham in Britain, the demographic replacement of all of our countries, everyone's got shit to deal with. And
yeah,
the special position of the special status of victimhood that Jews have had since the World War II, I think that lots of people no longer think it authorizes them to do things like this. If it ever did.
No, of course. But the point I'm trying to make here is that we know the story about the Holocaust. We're not talking about that. But if you, I mean, the Israeli ambassador to the UN, he put on a yellow star in the UN parliament because UN criticized Israel's actions. And he said, well, this is basically like you're persecuting us like the Holocaust. Well, no, you are the one keeping people in essentially a concentration camp. You are the one explicitly pursuing ethnic cleansing of said concentration camp, want to empty it out into the Egyptian border or whatever, or just kill them all or carpet bomb it or whatever. And when the concentration camp inmates rebel, you said, well, this is just like the Holocaust. I mean, no one is going to buy that story. No one is going to say that, well, yeah, you are actually the victims here. No, it's obvious. It's pretty obvious. I mean, it doesn't matter if you're sympathetic to Israel or not. even like Western Jews, like I said, they've been critical of Israel. They say that it's obvious who is the victim here. I mean, listen to like lectures by someone like Norman Finkelstein or other Jews. Another popular sort of Jew in social or in sort of on YouTube and elsewhere is Gabor Mate, who is this sort of psychologist and so on. He also has talked about this and so on. I mean, people are not buying this narrative.
I've put this photo up on screen of the UN envoys. This kind of thing, even if you were sympathetic to them, this cheapens, you know, I can imagine someone saying, well, I think Auschwitz was dreadful, worst thing that's ever happened, and all the rest of it. But then saying, but this cheapens Auschwitz. This cheapens the Holocaust. This is abusing that atrocity, and also abusing the sympathy that people have with the Jews for the Holocaust. You know, to just bring it out like this is ludicrous. I just wanted to make that point. Sorry to interrupt you, Frody.
No. You made a good point. I mean, if I had an event in my history that I thought was sacred because it sort of defines who we are because we went through some terrible event, then I would kind of be offended if people turned it into cheap pornography like this. I mean, I wouldn't find that appealing. And so, I think that this is really sort of a lot of Jews in the West want to wash their hands of what Israel is doing. But at the same time, if Israel performs ethnic cleansing of Gaza and Benjamin Netanyahu and his government takes the blame for it and everyone criticizes them, and then there's a change of government, will the new government that says that's a terrible, terrible thing that Benjamin Netanyahu did, will they reverse it? Will they change the situation, or will they actually take the benefit from the dirty work that the bad guy did? And that's really what I'm asking here. That's what I'm very curious to see, because that's sort of what I'm seeing here. What's going to happen? Probably the Benjamin Netanyahu and this sort of most radical Israeli government ever, in some people's opinion, is going to do something pretty nasty, something pretty devastating, and then a more mild government is going to come later and reap the benefits of that, and at the same time point the finger at the bad guy, say he did this. And
Netanyahu is a sort of fall guy then. He's there's a phrase for this, like a patsy. He does the bad thing, and then everyone around him gets to look superior but also benefit from the bad thing he did.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not trying to claim that this is planned out, that just sort of everyone is in on this big conspiracy, that's what they're trying to do here. I'm saying that I could see that's how it's going to play out. Not necessarily that's how it's planned, that's their intention, but I can see that's how it's going to be, how it's going to play out. There is a clip by Harry Truman, the American president, who was the first world leader to recognize Israel in 1948, American President Harry Truman, where he says that, you know, the Israelis, the Jews, they wanted all of Israel all at once. We can't do that. We have to give it to them in portions. So from the start, Israel was intended, the Israel that the Jews got, or that Israel got, the territory that Israel got in 1948 and onwards, was intended as a starting point. That's not the real borders of Israel. It's explicitly that was intended as a starting point, and then they're going to take more and more territory. And that's what we see playing out here in front of our eyes, that they think essentially this territory belongs to them. They don't want the Palestinians or the Gazans there. They want to drive them out and take it for themselves. And this is, again, I mean, sounds nuts. It sounds insane to people listening in the West. I mean, I would think that, well, is this parody? Is this guy talking now? Is he delusional? Is he insane? But look at Israeli media. That's what they're saying. I mean, Israeli media is very explicit and open about this. And like I said, Western Jews are very critical of this, that this is sort of Israel's policy. And that's why Israel is losing a lot of sympathy. But, you know, I could see it play out, like I said, that, you know, this is going to happen, and then a milder, more empathetic government takes over and sort of reaps the benefits and then gets to say, well, at least we're not as bad as that guy. You know, there's dirty things happen in politics and world history and in wars, and, you know, worse things have happened in the past. So this wouldn't be completely unique, but I could see it happening.
Of course, one other repercussion from all of this is that diaspora Jews, I think to some extent this makes it weakens their position as victims, because you know, a huge part, and I think they would even admit this, that a huge part of their influence in society is derived from their being victims in the past and in the recent past, you know, ejected from so many countries, so many people don't like them and have had it in for them, all the pogroms, and then, of course, the Holocaust. But now they look like villains as a people. Obviously, I don't mean every single one. And I the diaspora Jews are separate from the Israelis, and even the Israelis are separate from their government, of course. But nonetheless, for a lot of people, the defining action of Jews as a group at this moment in time is genocide of the Palestinians. And you know, that's bad PR. I'm not saying that it's the truth. I'm just saying it's how a lot of people see it. So it's bad PR.
It's bad PR, and that's why a lot of people are not going to buy the Israeli ambassador's yellow star in the UN parliament when every human rights organization says that, well, you're basically committing genocide. So, I mean, if you are the one committing genocide, then maybe you can't claim to be the victim of genocide at the same time. Maybe that's not going to actually work. People are not going to buy it. And that's why fewer and fewer people buy it. I mean, if you're going to portray yourself as the victim, you cannot be the sort of overwhelming aggressor against a powerless foe, essentially, that has no means of resisting your attacks. So that's why the sympathy is just going away. Because if we consider the Holocaust, I think events that happen now have a more immediate effect on people's emotions than things that happened 100 years ago, which were terrible and people feel sympathy for them. But, well, what you're doing now, is that really justified because of that? I mean, it wasn't the Palestinians who committed the Holocaust against the Jews. I mean, so the point is that I think a lot of these claims or these sort of emotional arguments don't really make a lot of sense to a lot of people hearing them.
Again, I've got this image etched in my mind from about a month ago of a small girl, and she was missing an arm. It had been blown off. And you cannot say that that's justified because of the Holocaust. It just isn't. That's an appalling thing to say. She is now disabled for the rest of her life. She was about 7 years old, I think. This is dreadful. And I know that war is hell and all that, but you cannot, especially when they're even saying that they're killing two civilians for every Hamas fighter. I mean, doesn't that mean that you're doing this wrong? Again, even if you're sympathetic to them because of the Holocaust, I think it still looks, the way they've conducted this counterstrike just looks absolutely awful. Inhumane, to say the least. So I really think they're going to have a hard time presenting themselves as the victims in the future. Ironically, the way it seems to be going now is that they're going to present themselves as the victims of the woke, which is absolutely perverse for obvious reasons. But it's all the non-whites and the hippie types, the peaceniks. They're the ones who are opposing the Gaza genocide. And you know, being anti-Semitic by doing so. So now the Jews can claim that they're victims of their own creation. It's just unbelievable, really. And again, what never is said in any of this is what is good for Europeans. You know, we can side with the Palestinians, we can side with the woke, we can side with the Jews, we can side with the diaspora Jews, the Israeli Jews. What about what's good for us? Because what's good for us is not 2 million Palestinians coming over. And it's not our countries being subverted by anyone. What is good for us is what is good for us. And yeah. We should be really focusing on that, because that's what everyone else is clearly focusing on. What's good for their group? I think what comes through in all of this is we really need to stop seeing the world through other people's eyes and trying to organize things to benefit other people's. Which group can we help today? Which group can we elevate today? Which group can we lionize today? What about us? And again, I think this is going to become an ever more pressing and desperate issue. What about us? Instead of thinking, like to go to the Ireland matter, which is a separate thing, but it's relevant to this. I can imagine people saying, well, but this refugee who raped a girl, he'd come from a war zone. So we've got to keep letting refugees in because they're from war zones. Or he'd, who knows, maybe it's economic, in which case he's going to pay tax, or maybe not, but it's the humane thing to the humanitarian thing to do, to let them in. Yeah. What's good for the Irish? And what's good for the Irish is for there not to be violent, rape-happy refugees in their vicinity. And so that should overwhelm every other concern for any Irish politician who's worthy of the name. And the same goes for every other European country.
No, I mean, I just want to say what I said again before. I mean, in several other issues, is how would this be applied in any other context? Suppose that I and my family was harassed and badly victimized by one neighbor. So I go and kill and massacre another neighbor and kill his whole family and say, well, how does that justification work? Okay, so Jews were victimized in Germany and in Poland and in other countries. And so they just have a carte blanche to expel and murder thousands and millions of people from Gaza who live under absolutely horrific circumstances. They don't get access to water and electricity and things like that. I mean, the argument doesn't make sense. It doesn't compute. It doesn't work, you know, saying that, well, this guy victimized me, so I'm completely justified in just killing this other guy and his whole family. That doesn't apply to any other context, and it doesn't apply here.
Absolutely. There are a few questions about this. Hold on a second. Let me see. Okay. Black Pigeon Pilled asked, okay, Jonathan Doe, first of all, said Merry Christmas and a very Happy New Year. Thank you very much, Jonathan. Black Pigeon Pilled, do you think Israel will try to do the same thing, re-Christian Zionism, Friends for Israel, AIPAC, etc., but in China, India, or whomever else surpasses America? Do you think there will be a Jewish lobby in these new powers?
No, I think the Jewish lobby is, and this is probably not a popular thing to say, but I think it's deeply connected with Christianity and with the fact that, you know, Jews have been mixed as well with European populations. A lot of Jews look European or could at least pass as sort of similar to us. And I think that, the sort of J. Philip Rushton theory of similarity, I forget what it's called. It's a long time since I read sociobiology, I'm sorry, but basically the fact that if we're, the more similar we are to other people, the easier we have to sympathize with them. It's just, we're hardwired like that. It's easier for us to have a successful relationship with someone who is similar to us and so on. And so it's easier for Jews to become a part of society and communicate effectively with Europeans and white people than with Chinese or others. I mean, because it's a completely different race of people. And so it's just, they can see that, but this is clearly a distinct group. Why should we listen to them? Also, the Chinese and other races have a very different and more group-oriented or tribal mentality rather than Europeans are uniquely individualistic in their mindset. And also Christianity. I think it's obvious that if you have a religion which says that this is God's chosen people, or this is a people that have play the central role in your holy book, that we should have some sort of special relationship to them, or they should play some sort of role in your society. I think that there's a relationship there. I think that correlates pretty obviously. Whereas when you have a completely different culture and a completely different race, it's very difficult to say, well, why are these people here? I mean, I'm saying here what the Chinese and other groups will think. What are those people doing here? Why are they telling us, you know, what's good or bad or right or wrong and so on? They don't belong here. So it's much more difficult to become a part of that group and become sort of a credible part of their in-group. I think Jews are largely considered to be part of, I mean, I'm talking about the majority perception here, are largely considered to be part of the in-group in the West, and especially in America.
Yeah, I think it would be more difficult for them, for the reasons that Frody said, to blend in. Although it should be said that there were a number of Jews high up in the Chinese Communist Party.
Yeah, and in South Africa and so on, yeah.
Yeah, South Africa as well. But then they would have been the other. For those blacks who were, so it's not quite the same thing as in the West, where they are able to very much say my fellow white people and so forth. All right, and then another question was: does Frody think that Israel is ultimately unsustainable, given the recent PR disaster of the Gaza offensive and internal unrest towards Netanyahu's Likud government? So do you think that Israel is unsustainable? Do you think it will be that the end for it has been written here? Or do you think that it's got a future?
Not at all. I think Israel definitely has a future. I don't think that this is any kind of irreparable damage. I think, like I said, I think that, you know, mass media perception is very important. So if we say that, well, Benjamin Netanyahu was a very bad guy, now we have a more liberal, a more humane government, it's time to turn the page and move on. We can't keep talking about all the bad things that happened yesterday. Tomorrow is more important than yesterday. We have to forget all the... We can't, continue to bear a grudge against someone for some bad things. And it wasn't this government anyway. It was that old, bad, evil government who did it. And I think, you know, it easily can play out like that. And then this will be forgotten more or less, at least within years, maybe even within months, because the mass media will move on to distract you with the next event, next big issue. And this will sort of go down the memory hole, or this will sort of be forgotten or swept under the rug. And you know, the way propaganda works or manipulation isn't so much, you know, lying or saying that this happened or this didn't happen. It's just not to talk about it. I mean, when you went to school, how much did you hear about the King David Hotel bombing? They just don't talk about it. They don't say, oh, it didn't happen. They just don't talk about it in the mass media. And so people don't know about it. And so it doesn't affect their standing or their sort of moral position.
Yes. Okay. Not Finished has said something that I don't want to read out. Hold on a second. Yeah. I can't read that out. I'm sure you understand why. But nonetheless, thank you for the super chat. Okay, and Total Kermit Domination says, great respect for both of you gentlemen. Merry Christmas and good Yule to all. Thank you very much.
Merry Christmas.
And Blarney says, Merry Christmas and a generous donation. Thank you very much for that. And Merry Christmas to you. I guess that is everything, unless there's anything else that you'd like to say, Frody.
No, I think this has been an excellent conversation. I think we talked about a lot of important topics, both positive and negative things, but I think we covered a lot of good ground. I've really enjoyed it. I enjoy Millennial all the time, every year. I'm a big fan of the work that you've done. I think you've established yourself as a very important voice. And I like the fact that you don't have any kind of ideological orthodoxy about who you have on. You talk to a lot of interesting people, and I think that's that's what's needed, you know, just talking to different kinds of interesting people and so on. So I just want to encourage everyone who's been watching. I mean, I know firsthand how much work goes into something like this. I've done the Cameron Film Festival. I've done conferences. A lot of work goes into it. So if you can support WOES, please do that, because this is invaluable. This kind of event is just, it cannot be measured how valuable this is. And if anyone wants to see me, you can find me on my channel. You can go to gtkradio.com, for example, to find my website. I have a weekly roundup, which is my weekly news commentary and current affairs commentary. I also do other kinds of stuff, but you'll find all my work there on Guide to Culture and gtkradio.com.
Excellent. And all your links will be in the description. So thank you for that. I should
and of
say,
course, Merry Christmas to everyone and Happy New Year.
Indeed, we are 8 minutes into Christmas Day here in Britain. I guess an hour and eight where you are. So, yes, that's a very important thing to say to everyone. I've got Pox Populi coming up next and then the Christmas card stream. And then that'll be it for tonight. But before we go, I want to say that you are going to do Decameron next year, and you've invited me on. And I'm not quite sure what I'm going to be talking about. It might be an episode of Upstairs, Downstairs, or there's a particular episode that I think is fantastic. It's about champagne socialism. Or there's a film. It wasn't shown at the cinema. It was shown on British TV in the early 70s, and it's called Edna the Inebriate Woman. And it's about a homeless, alcoholic woman. And it's not a comedy. It's very much a serious, like, social commentary kind of film, but it's really nicely made. And I'm not sure yet which one of those I'll talk about. I've put up a poll, actually. I've created a poll here, which people can vote in. So please do that. And I will, whichever option wins that poll, I will talk about it on Decameron. It's either the Upstairs Downstairs episode about champagne socialism, or it's Edna the Inebriate Woman, about a drunken homeless woman. So I understand why neither of those options might seem altogether inviting, but believe me, no, they are both very good and very much worth talking about.
I love finding out about new things. I don't know either of those options, so I'd be happy to watch and digest and talk about either of those. I love finding out about new films, new TV shows, new information, everything like that. I'm just extremely curious, so I'm happy to talk about those things.
Excellent. Okay. All right, well, we'll see what the results of that poll are in due course. Okay, so I'll be back soon with Pox Populi. Frode Midyard, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2023.
Thank you so much. Merry Christmas.
Okay, Merry Christmas.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The journey must continue, but it needs your help. T-shirts and mugs and other wondrous gifts are available at the merchandise store. Impress your family, friends, colleagues, and business partners with these incredible items.
All aboard!
Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the journey and spread the word. We'll be right back.